You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for May 1st, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign and lawn care emporium, it's The Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Sam, our listener Sam, who has been on the show before talking about Medicare and Medicaid and breast cancer. I don't know if you remember that. He was the breast cancer expert who left us a voicemail one time, a long time ago. But he went to a Bernie Sanders event in South Carolina this week.
Wow.
Before anyone, this was 5 days ago, before anyone thought he was even going to run. The announcement hadn't been made yet. And he wrote to us, he wrote me a letter, and he said, Bernie Sanders will be here today. Send me $3.
It's on the way, Sam.
Just kidding, he says. He spoke in Columbia, South Carolina. He attended some Democratic Party events. Sam wrote, if Bernie does run, it will be in spite of his experience here in Columbia, South Carolina. It was obvious at the luncheon, even though there were more attendees than expected, that the left here is weak, discouraged, and in disarray. Yeah. As for the South Carolina Democratic Party, I will be surprised if any leader encourages Bernie to run. In 2008, South Carolina Democratic Party leaders encouraged Obama because they thought he would be better than Hillary for local turnout. In 2016, Hillary might be better for turnout here than Bernie. Organizing turnout really is a problem, by the way, and he indicates not just here. Phone banks don't work anymore. People on tight budgets don't have landlines. You can spend an hour dialing and do well to talk to one person. Door-to-door misses all those people who are out working long and also untraditional hours.
Yep.
He noted that there were 200 people at this lunch. And Bernie Sanders paid for the food, which was modest but edible. They had – do you want to hear what they had?
I do.
They had Swedish meatballs, crackers, cheese and crackers, pulled pork, coleslaw, bread, cut up fruit, and bug juice. I guess that means sweet juice. The South Carolina Democratic Party chairman introduced Bernie with much praise. Sanders says he'll decide soon whether to run for president. Can we get an organization and money that can generate votes? That will be the basis for his decision, which clearly he'd already decided. He went through all of his stuff about the middle class and that we have more poverty than other countries. And he wants a government jobs infrastructure proposal and solar, wind, and geothermal power. And we need a political revolution in this country. It sounded like a stump speech, says Sam, but then he got to the point. He asked the audience if we are ready to get involved. He said we should be truthful and not flatter him about whether people will act. He challenges us why our state keeps voting for Republicans like your two senators. Why are people not standing up? Seriously challenge the audience to explain voting patterns and whether they can change. People are afraid of government here. The audience was maybe 25% African-American. Sanders said that government can be anything we want it to be if we organize to get it. And Bernie went full drift glass on a questioner who complained about congressional salaries. Because the idea that all politicians are bad preserves the control by the rich. We need a movement of millions of people to overcome the millions of dollars. And I tend to be pessimistic about Bernie's chances. The people that the Democrats need here just don't vote.
Yeah.
Voting doesn't matter to them. They don't expect help from the government, yet they take for granted what they get from the government. Mm-hmm. They don't think that they know enough to be responsible voters, and they don't think that learning would be worth the time and effort. They have other things to do on election day, like working. That also applies to early voting days, unless it's a Sunday and the church provides a van.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And then once he wrote me again 2 days later to say, Bernie is running. I'm surprised based on what I saw. Maybe his thinking is that by running, he'll have opportunities to articulate his liberal ideas in the media. Also, he may be doing Senator Professor Warren a service by distracting the stalkers. That's interesting, too.
Yeah.
But thank you, Sam, for writing us with all that. And I certainly hope that Bernie Sanders does better than expected in terms of getting his message out. I have a post up at Crooks and Liars about Throwback Thursday and Chuck Todd.
Which you pulled out of your, which you pulled right out of the memory hole. You really
did. Well, I remembered it because it was a terrible moment for Washington media. It was one of those things that just stays with you because it was so blatantly gatekeeperish of Chuck Todd. It was a week in December of 2010. There was a tax bill coming up, and Bernie Sanders did a one-day filibuster. And many of you, many of our listeners will remember everybody turning on C-SPAN, which we only the only time we've ever done that in the past 5 years was when Stephen Colbert was on to talk about migrant labor, which during which time, by the way, Chuck Todd was also a dick, I will tell you. But in this instance, Bernie Sanders had done a one-day filibuster.
A magnificent filibuster.
And
filibuster.
And as I said in my post, it was published in a book, as a book. The filibuster, not reading Green Eggs and Ham, but talking for 8 hours about the economy and how it affects average Americans and why the game is rigged against them and how we can fix that. And
It was a masterclass in public policy. It really was. It was a wonderful extended lesson in how democracy works and how the economy works and how the rich work and how corporations work. And how politics is the servant of those, and it was substantive and useful, and it was not to put a plug in, but it was the sort of thing that we used to get from people like Chris Hayes on a Saturday and Sunday morning. You know, it was nourishing, and it could have been.
And it was published as a book. It is still available at online and other booksellers. Published as a book called The Speech. In contrast to Ted Cruz's filibuster and Rand Paul's filibuster, you know, I gotta go potty. Green Eggs and Ham, I gotta go potty. So Chuck Todd was on the following Monday, was on Hardball. And what had happened on Friday afternoon was Barack Obama held a press conference and Bill Clinton came along for the press conference to explain that this bipartisan tax bill, which, by the way, extended the Bush tax cuts, was not perfect, but we shouldn't let perfect be the enemy of the good. And that as Bill Clinton said, bipartisan bills are never acceptable to partisans. And this is the best deal we're going to get, and we should pass it. And it was a way the Senate had passed it, and it was a way of pulling some House members, Democratic House members in the Nancy Pelosi caucus into voting for further extension of the Bush tax cuts. And so here is Chuck Todd. And by the way, Mark Halperin was on too.
Oh, God.
At the same time.
It was so bad. It was so bad.
And they start talking about how awesome it was that Bill Clinton was on TV on a Friday afternoon because it was a circuit breaker in the news cycle and gave us something to talk about all weekend.
Uh-huh.
And Chuck Todd said, yes, I actually joked with some White House staffers about, are you going to give us anything? Because otherwise I've got 8 hours of Bernie Sanders tape I can run.
Uh-huh. And he was serious. I'm semi-serious.
He was serious.
I almost had to talk about something substantive.
Yeah.
And then I was saved.
And then Elvis came into the room. Now, he literally said that. Elvis came into the room and Chris Matthews, who was sitting there having orgasms over Bill Clinton's magnificence and sublimity, said, Elvis always beats out Ben and Jerry's. And we're done. And that is why, you know, I'm glad that Bernie Sanders is running for president. I hope it means he goes on fucking Meet the Press and tells Chuck Todd to shove it up his ass.
Well, and that's, I mean, we talk a lot about it.
Oh, wait a minute. Except, Griff Glass, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders was on Meet the Press in the past 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And Chuck Todd kept fishing around with him to get an anti-Hillary soundbite out of him.
Sure. That's all they want.
Because that's all he wants.
All he wants.
I'm so tired of it.
Well, this is, you know, we talk a lot about on this podcast, almost to a fault sometimes in my case, that, you know, why do you keep focusing on these two or three major issues? And it's because, like things like David Brooks, it's because these people really, in a very literal sense, shape the agenda for what we talk about in public.
And well, not only what we talk about, but what gets through the Congress and what actually gets done. Yeah.
But that's absolutely true. But it's also the things that get to that point are the things that are talked about.
Yeah.
Are discussed. There was a genuine opportunity. I mean, you had Chuck Todd saying essentially we have a dead, you know, news day. Yeah. We have nothing left to talk about. Here's Bernie Sanders handing you a 10-course meal in public policy that if you had half a fucking brain, that is news. A, the filibuster is news. What he's talking about is news, is real news. This is how your country is being slowly demolished by special interests. But Chuck Todd works for those special interests.
Yeah.
He has no interest in talking about the real problems of this country. So he's sitting there going, oh, shit, what do? I have to fill time. I have to make up something. Oh, thank God Bill Clinton showed up to talk about bipartisanship. And in that, and he and Halperin and Chris Matthews just sitting around giggling about it. Because, holy crap, we almost were forced by boredom and circumstance and the cable news cycle to talk about something substantive. Thank God we didn't have to do that. And that really is, in a nutshell, I'm so glad you remembered this and pulled it out of the time closet. Because that really is the problem. There are plenty of things to talk about other than the horse race. There are tons of things to talk about. It is that people like Chuck Todd and Mark Halperin and Chris Wallace, Chris Wallace, because they're all Chris's, aren't they?
Yeah, Chris Matthews yeah.
Have absolutely no interest in talking about those things and will actively avoid doing so. They will ban those subjects from discussion because those subjects come down to pointing out that one side is right and one side is wrong. And one side has a track record of fucking things up and taking your money and destroying your country, and another side doesn't. And here's a plan that wants to cut your mother's Medicaid off to take your father's Social Security away. And here's a plan where that doesn't happen. Here's a plan where you get screwed. Here's a plan where your life gets better. We could have those discussions every single day in this country, but people like Chuck Todd do not want to have them.
And you know, those Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid issues are hypotheticals. I think people... Bernie Sanders said that when he talks about the House GOP budget, people think he's lying because they're so draconian. The cuts are so draconian that people just can't believe that anyone would actually vote for something like that.
Sure.
When actually they did and they passed it.
Yeah.
But the real fact that really exists today of a minimum wage being below the poverty line for people. That's just going on right now. That is the pay that people are getting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a hypothetical. It's not something that Obama's veto pen can stop.
No.
And so if Chuck Todd would talk every time he's on the air about two things, why is the minimum wage a poverty wage? And number two, why does it take 60 votes to get anything through the Senate? Who made that decision? That wasn't the way it was 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
That was a decision made by one party to make it that way. And it's an abuse of the filibuster rule. If you talked about just those two things all the time, something would happen.
Yes.
Chuck Todd does have that much power. I think he could change things if he wanted to, but he's part of the BlackBerry class of Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
And God forbid he should do that. So anyway, I hope we have sufficiently shit on Chuck Todd today to make everyone really mad at him, because I'm really mad at him. And I hope Bernie Sanders stays in this race for a good long time. That said, I was impressed with Hillary Clinton's speech on Baltimore, and that's where we're going next, is Baltimore. What if you just talked about you want to talk about the Amtrak Acela train? I think this is a wonderful article in
just as a metaphor.
Huffington Post. Yeah. Yeah.
All over the Morning Joe show. There is a train. There's a train that if you can get on in Washington and it'll take you to your
New York City.
Far away. and vice versa. And it's the Acela. It's called the Acela Corridor. It's a train line, and it is where all of the news people commute. It's their commuter train. It's and on it you will find Chuck Todd. And you'll find.
Let's be clear. It's a high speed deluxe Amtrak train between New York and Washington.
Yeah,
and news celebrities use it, and yeah. congressmen use it to get from New York to Washington.
This is,
yeah,
this is how David Brooks gets from one end of a sentence to another. because geography is destiny, this train line actually passes through Baltimore.
Through West Baltimore, through the poor neighborhoods.
Through the poor neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so through their tinted windows, they can glimpse all the terrible poverty those people have. It is something out of the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This very fast form of modern transportation whisking you through District 7. Where you can catch a glimpse of the natives in their native environment. Isn't it just a darn shame what's happened to those people out there? And that's all they know. And so you have them literally saying, Mike Barnicle and Joe Scarborough and those people talking about Baltimore as they have seen it through the window of their deluxe train for the last many years. And isn't it a shame the public policy has failed those people so terribly? And it's not a story so much as it's a perfect fucking metaphor for our class system, that it really is a different planet. You don't have to visit it. You can take a little space shuttle. You can take it's like Jurassic Park. You can get on the little tram and you can ride through and you can watch the dinosaurs and you can watch the pterodactyls and you can watch the raptors eating each other, but you're never in any danger. You're just observing as you slide right on through. And then at the end of your terrible trip, you can talk about all the things you saw. And isn't it a shame? And isn't it a sad thing? And isn't it awful? And blah, 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 blah. Fine. Do 2 weeks on urban deindustrialization and then get back to me on how much you care about what's going on in Baltimore. Do 2 weeks on the crumbling infrastructure and the rotten school system. Then tell me about it. Do 2 weeks on what Reaganomics, what trickle-down economics, what supply-side economics did to this fucking country, and that we're all still paying the price for. Then get back to me. But we're not going to hear those shows. There's never going to be a show on any of those subjects, because those subjects have to do with winners and losers. Those subjects would put the people that pay Joe Scarborough's salary on the witness stand.
Yep.
And ask them to talk about how badly they've screwed up as stewards of this country. So those shows are never going to happen. Instead, we're going to get Rand Paul talking about fathers and fatherhood. And we're going to end up talking about riots and what's really wrong. And isn't it a shame? And some of those issues might have currency and some might not. But the idea that these incredibly privileged people just sail through this, through our world, through their world, completely untouched by circumstances.
Well, and I just went and looked up how much a first-class ticket from Washington to New York is on the Acela Express.
Yeah.
It would take a minimum wage worker more than a week to buy one ticket. It's $277 one way on the Acela Express, one way from Washington to New York first class. So, yeah, for one ticket, $277. That's 38.2 hours at $725 if you don't take into account any deductions or taxes. So they're going to work a week and a half to buy one ticket on that train. That is not accessible to anybody. That is the elite riding, you know, for work. And your secretary calls and takes the business account, the business American Express card, and charges your train ticket so you can be in New York by dinner time.
Yeah.
That's why they get to talk about, like you say, fathers. Rand Paul, whose son is having DUI problems. And, you know, that wouldn't be an issue, Rand, if you didn't open your pie hole and start talking about other people not having fathers.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And, well, and let me also point out that high-speed rail is, if we invested in it, if we took tax money and we invested in it, we could put high-speed rail all over this country. We could employ a bunch of those people in Baltimore and in Chicago and in Philadelphia and in Detroit to work building high-speed rail all over this country. And we could have a situation where you could work in Chicago and live in Springfield and be home in 90 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You really could. You could transform this country as radically – when it comes to work and life and the ability to move people around quickly and efficiently, goods and services, and the ability to put people to work building infrastructure.
And spreading out living space so that you don't have to be concentrated in a place where rents are incredibly high in order to work in a place where there's jobs. Yeah.
As much as the interstate highway system did for this country, high-speed rail could do that. But we're not going to have that conversation either.
No, let's not forget it's perfectly fine to build that Acela rail system with taxpayer dollars because David Brooks needs it.
I gotta get home to my empty house because my wife left. Well, although he is not allowed to talk about his divorce for legal reasons. Brian Lamb asked him that question on C-SPAN, and he replied that he wasn't allowed to talk about it for legal reasons. I can't figure out what those would be. I can't imagine.
A gag order. They've got a mutual gag order not to talk shit about each other. Uh-huh. And he clearly bought her silence and made it mutual because that's what lawyers do.
Yep.
And, you know, so you won't talk smack about me to the media. And I won't talk smack about you and you'll get a check. And that's how that's done.
That's why my emails to his ex go unanswered.
Who is this drift glass person and how does he know my ex-husband so well?
Can
you want to do Bible Bitch?
Bible Bitch.
That's not scriptural.
Love Bible Bitch.
Yeah, we love Bible Bitch. And I'm going to read from Jeremiah again because it's just time.
Jesus, you and Jeremiah, why don't you get a room?
Well, Jeremiah, as I've been reading through the Bible, and we take a snippet of different books each day during the week, and really there is a theme in the Bible of God really being angry at people who have power and use it badly, use it for self-aggrandizement, use it not to serve others but to serve themselves. And that goes for Jesus, that goes for Jeremiah, that goes in the early books of the Bible in Exodus. If you have power and you use it for yourself or to further your own ends instead of serving humanity, God really has a problem with that. And so this is from Jeremiah 22 and 23, and I have excerpted it from the Message. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this is long enough. And the first half addresses people in power in the king's palace, and the second half addresses Mike Huckabee. So I hope you enjoy it.
It's not Mike.
So this is Jeremiah 22 and 23. God's orders. Go to the royal palace and deliver this message. Say, listen to what God says. You and your officials and all the people who go in and out of these palace gates, this is God's message. Attend to matters of justice. Set things right between people. Rescue victims from their exploiters. Don't take advantage of the homeless, the orphans, the widows. Stop the murdering. Doom to him who builds palaces but bullies people, who makes a fine house but destroys lives, who cheats his workers and won't pay them for their work, who says, I'll build me an elaborate mansion with spacious rooms and fancy windows. I'll bring in rare and expensive woods and the latest in interior decor. So that makes you a king living in a fancy palace? Your father got along just fine, didn't he? He did what was right and treated people fairly. And things went well with him. He stuck up for the down and out. And things went well for Judah.
We're talking about Mitt Romney.
Isn't this what it means to know me? But you're blind and brainless. All you think about is yourself, taking advantage of the weak, bulldozing your way, bullying victims. Now, for what God says regarding the lying prophets.
Oh, man. I'm guessing it's not good.
They have nothing to do with me as their God. Don't listen to the sermons of the prophets. It's all hot air. Lies, lies, and more lies. They make it all up. Not a word they speak comes from me. They preach their everything will turn out fine sermon to congregations with no taste for God. Their nothing bad will ever happen to you sermon to people who are set in their own ways. Have any of these prophets bothered to meet with me, the true God, bothered to take in what I have to say, listened to, and then lived out my word? Am I not a God at hand and not a God far off? Can anyone hide out in a corner where I can't see him? Am I not present everywhere, whether seen or unseen? I've had it with the prophets who get all their sermons secondhand from each other. Yes, I've had it with them. They make up stuff and then pretend it's a real sermon. Oh, yes, I've had it with the prophets who preach the lies they dream up, spreading them all over the country, ruining the lives of my people with their cheap and reckless lies. I never sent these prophets, never authorized a single one of them. They do nothing for this people. Nothing. Instead of claiming to know what God says, ask questions of one another, such as, how do we understand God in this? But don't go around pretending to know it all, saying, God told me this and God told me that. I don't want to hear it anymore. Are you paying attention? You'd better. Because I'm about to take you in hand and throw you to the ground. You and this entire city that I gave to your ancestors. I've had it with the lot of you. You're never going to live this down. You're going down in history as a disgrace.
All right.
And so,
God goes full drift glass. That's great.
God goes full drift glass. Amen.
Yeah.
And Mike Huckabee saying that, you know, the Supreme Court can't overturn God. What a fuckwad.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com.
We want to talk about Baltimore today, and I particularly want to highlight an article by Carolee over at Crooks and Liars about Baltimore and housing and lead paint. And that sounds like you're sort of going off on some divergent track, but it's all connected. And it turns out that particularly in Baltimore, the Maryland legislature let landlords off the hook if they cleaned up the lead paint that was on their property for years. They finally just said, okay, we won't sue you for liability. You will be held not liable if you clean it up, if you get rid of it on your property. And the kind of power structure that allows poor people, and this is an issue of poverty, not race, that allows poor people to continually be exploited is part of the picture of Baltimore and all of the other cities where these injustices are happening and people are rising up against them.
Uh-huh.
So I recommend that article highly. And I'll put it up in our links in Facebook. By the way, people who are looking for articles that are mentioned on the podcast, for the most part, we try really hard to link them at our blogs. And you can Google Driftglass or you can Google Blue Gal and find them at our blogs. We're glad to share those. And if you see something missing, just email us, proleftpodcast@gmail.com. But we try to get those up the day of the podcast.
Old blogging tradition. Always link.
Always link. Right.
Always link.
Right. We also wanted to talk about a local story that is very much part of the picture of how to get it right when it comes to poverty and housing.
Yeah.
And I think there is a genuine effort here in Springfield with this one housing development to get it right because of the involvement of a couple of aldermen. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's a small scale example. But is another case where just below the headlines, there was an apartment complex right down the street from us, more or less.
Yeah.
That was a mess, a hot mess for years. It was, you know, crime ridden. Mm-hmm. It was there were a lot of boarded up buildings, a lot of people who shouldn't be there camping out there. It was your stereotypical bad neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of people decided they would try to figure out what was wrong with the neighborhood and help them fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved everybody. This is the trick. It involved actual investment in the neighborhood, actual true real investment in the neighborhood. But it also involved getting the police out of their cars integrated into the neighborhood.
Right. And introducing themselves as human beings, as part of a community support structure rather than a law enforcement structure.
It involved getting the worst offenders out. Mm-hmm. It involved cleaning the property up.
It involved getting the landlord, who eventually died. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but it really involved fixing the problem with an absentee landlord who absolutely did not give a shit, who was there to collect Section 8 money and live in Florida or wherever he lived. He didn't live in Springfield. And collected the money and to enforce the law regarding standards of housing, that the regulations regarding what electricity needs to look like in a building, what paint needs to look like, what windows need to look like. And, you know, there are standards for condemning a building if it doesn't have X, Y, and Z. And a lot of times landlords get around that.
Well,
it was about upholding the law. If we're going to talk about upholding the law, how about upholding structural damage regulations that say you cannot collect rent on a building that is below these standards?
Exactly. Well, and it involved local business leaders, local politicians, local civic organizations, local churches. It involved all of these different groups deciding to help the neighborhood back on its feet. And they put in a library and they put in a children's center. And they found out at the library that the kids were showing up and they couldn't, they were hungry. So, we should provide snacks for them after school. So then we'll put fresh fruit in there. We'll get snacks for the kids. They got a local organization that builds gardens to build a fairly substantial community garden.
Yeah, it is a substantial community garden.
To grow fresh fruit, fresh food, which is not exactly available at their fingertips. It's close. It's not a food desert. But having a garden in the middle of your neighborhood does something to the neighborhood. Getting rid of the people who should not be there and making sure the people who are there know that they can call the police and the police will be there as fellow residents, fellow community members. And the crime rate plummeted. I believe February, there was no reported anything coming from that neighborhood.
Of course, it was bitterly cold in February, too. But bitterly cold months have had crime there in the past.
So the crime rate dropped. The number of families who live there has gone up. The number of kids who live there. It's a community now. It's still poor. There's still poor people in there. But it is a mixture of different types of people, mostly families, mostly raising their kids and going off to work and working. Nobody works at the New York Times. There are no TV moguls who live in there. There's no trains that zip in and out of there and just glance over their shoulder and go on. It's a part of our community, and a lot of people came together to do some really simple housekeeping and some very basic things to help that neighborhood back on its feet, and it's worked.
It's really worked, the image that this apartment complex has, and it's an apartment complex, a large one.
Yeah.
The image in the city is now one of a success story rather than a slum. And so, and that humanizes the image of the people that live there.
Well, because, and this is also, this is also what we say always on this podcast. I mean, we rail against the entrenched power and the bureaucracy and the failure of the media and all the sort of the giant hulking things, the monsters, the titans on our horizon that are screwing up the whole country. But we also remember, always say, get involved locally.
Yeah.
Find something locally you can do to make your community better. That way you can, and there are people working to solve this problem who would have nothing to do with each other politically. I know it. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
There are people who have.
You've sat at the table with those people.
Yeah.
I know you have.
Yeah. And they have.
You volunteer for cleanups, and we volunteer at school, and we volunteer all over the place. So.
And we can fight about the abstract tax policy and what and big government and whether or not Vince Foster was murdered. on a different day. But today, we're all going to roll up our sleeves and clean this place up and help these people have a little bit of a better life. And you know what it does also? It raises property values.
Yeah, around the whole area.
Yep. It creates a stable environment for kids who have single moms who can go to school. It creates a place where people can go off to a job and come back home again to the neighborhood that they kind of like. It creates taxpayers. It creates decent citizens. It creates another generation of people who don't think of this place as a place you want to get the hell away from. It is a small investment, but passionate investment of time and energy, and it pays big dividends. And there's no reason on earth why you cannot scale those things upward. Now, when it comes to putting in big infrastructure, you need big money. You need actual capital investment in neighborhoods. There's a you need to put grocery stores, and you need to put drug stores, and you need to support local businesses. Those are the things that build your local community. But it's all doable. The flip side of this argument, if I may, I'm not going to segue too hard into here, but I will just say this. Today, David Brooks wrote a column on poverty.
Oh, no, he didn't.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And he shared with his 800,000 readers, which is what he has on any given day worldwide, what he believes the real problems of poverty are. And you know what? The real problems are not. I'll give you a spoiler. I'm not going to go into it in great depth because Twitter went full drift glass already.
That's got to make you feel good, though.
It just was holy shit. Why? Shut up. Yeah. Shut up, you
asshole.
Isn't
that what John Stewart just finally has started saying with some people? Shut up.
Well, actually, David Brooks quotes John Stewart in his column because he said, you know, John Stewart got an applause line talking about how we spent $1 trillion to rebuild Afghanistan. How about we spend a little bit of that in the United States? Yay. And Brooks said, well, you know, that was all very satisfying. But really, this has nothing to do with money. It's not for lack of money or community investment. And here's the spoiler. It's not because there's a lack of jobs. It's not because there's no deindustrialization or food deserts or shitty schools. It's not a class thing or a race thing or a war on drugs thing.
It's a morality thing.
It's those invisible interactions at the individual level that happen. And oh, if only we could see poverty through a lens of social psychology. Yeah. And people just went, fuck you. And first of all, It doesn't even get into how he brutally abuses statistics to make his point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we just gave people a check for what we spend per year on poverty, a family of four would have $14,000 each, and that would collectively raise them above the poverty level. Now, he's not proposing doing that, but he doesn't say that, you know, a big chunk of that is healthcare. And that's not something you cut a check for. You know, start taking out the social services that you cannot parse out that way, that aren't designed to get rid of poverty. They're just designed to make sure you don't starve to death and that you can take your kid to the emergency room and get them treated. But that doesn't interest him. Those problems are not David Brooks's problems. Those are the problems of a privileged, insufferable asshole who has a job for life with the biggest megaphone in media telling other privileged white people that it's not about giving these poor people more money because that won't solve the problem. All of the causal effects are things that David Brooks doesn't want to fucking talk about.
You know why? Because the world is waiting for a thinker who can describe poverty through the lens of social psychology, Dirkland.
Oh, you found it.
I found it.
Yeah. That's what we really need. And this is
barf.
David Brooks is setting up a church. Go read my post called The Church of Liontology. Church of Liontology. It's very simple. David Brooks is just wrong all the time about everything.
Well, and can we talk? Can we connect David Brooks now? Also, and I do want to refer people to your post, Church of Liontology. It's a really good post. I think it's your best of the week.
Thank you.
Connect all of this with Trans-Pacific Partnership. I said pipeline all time last week.
I know.
Trans-Pacific Partnership. Uh-huh. Tom Friedman just thinks it's awesome.
Yeah, of course.
And Judith Miller on The Daily Show, because I think there is a commonality.
There is.
With these three folks.
There absolutely is.
And it's not just the New York Times. It's more a kind of, we're up here at Davos and the rest of you, we're allowed to analyze you and forgive ourselves for being wrong and forget about the past. And anybody who calls us on our bullshit just has a different opinion.
Judith Miller has a different strategy. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
David Brooks' strategy, because he has a vast history of being horribly fucking wrong about everything.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you talk about money or history or dates or people or facts or causality, he ends up looking really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Because all you have to do is click on one of his old posts and say, well, this is what you said before and you were really, really wrong.
I don't think I ever wrote that.
Yeah, I don't think I ever wrote that. You wrote a lot about divorce. I never wrote about divorce. So his short-term method is the same as Judith Miller, which is just denial. I never said those things. That never happened. And because he's surrounded by a bunch of cronies and hacks and colleagues who suck his dick and make him their god, and they really do. He is a revered figure. He is the leading media figure he's the most powerful person in media, I would argue, who doesn't own a media company.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But his problem is his entire past conspires against him. So he wants to get a divorce from his past. He wants to file for divorce from his own history.
And you've been watching Wolf Hall. So you this is really about Henry VIII and David Brooks being.
Exactly. He has to get a divorce from this very inconvenient past that has been he has dragging around behind him. But how do you do that? How do you get rid of 30 years of horribly stupid predictions? Well, you just get rid of any mention of facts or math. Or economics, or foreign policy. You shift the entire discussion over to one of morality. A nice, soft, squishy subject. You talk about it in very humble terms. And you talk about how we're all wrong. And how God, you know, God must this and God must that. And you become a rabbi. You become the rabbi of the conservative movement. And you talk very humbly about how some people get things wrong, but eventually we'll get them right. And you know how we're all imperfect creatures and how we need to be more humble. And all the while still commenting on the same shit you've been commenting on for years, but any discussion of the actual shit you said versus the actual shit that happened in the world is now off the table. I don't have to deny it. I'm just not going to talk in terms of fact-based reality anymore. I'm going to talk in the language of religion and faith, except my church, David Brooks' church, is one where you don't have to atone for anything. You don't have to be forgiven for anything. You don't even have to admit your sins. You know, there's no confession. There's no atonement. There's just redemption. Constant, ongoing, revolving door redemption for all of David Brooks's media friends. And a lot of them are finding this Church of Lyontology really effective because they just will just forget the past. The past never happened. Now, Judith Miller has a different approach, which is flat out denial. You know, just, I never said that stuff. John Stewart, yes, you fucking did, and here it is. Well, you know, everybody got it wrong. And so her approach is much more blunt because she's a Fox News employee. She has to just declare that the past never happened, period.
And then when he calls her on it and says, yes, you did, you were fed this by the White House. Well, and she turned it into, it's your opinion.
Right.
And when it becomes two opinions clashing rather than facts as opposed to lies,
mm-hmm.
she wins.
Who can say who is right or wrong?
Yeah.
Who knows
yeah.
who is right
yeah.
or wrong?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Tom Friedman the same way. Tom Friedman doesn't just... David Brooks still has a foot in the real world where he has to actually, you know, interact with human beings on an occasional basis. Tom Friedman just floats above everything. Tom Friedman is a billionaire. Tom Friedman never has to worry about anything ever again in his life. Tom Friedman is equally unfireable from his job at the New York Times. So he can just ramble on and write his columns about China, jobs, and the internet, to coin an internet meme, to quote an internet meme. And nobody's going to call him on. Nobody's going to say anything. People just look at him like, Jesus Christ, another fucking Tom Friedman column about free trade and how awesome it is for everybody. Except by everybody, we mean Tom and his nine friends. That's
mm-hmm,
who we
mm-hmm.
But he doesn't even bother to pretend the past happened at all. He doesn't address it in any way. It never comes up in his columns. He just moves. It's like little ship in a bottle episodes on a TV show. There's no relationship between this episode and the last episode.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different cab driver.
It was
a completely different cab driver. I was in a completely different cab. So,
uh-huh.
All right, we got to move on. I want to talk about a rather shocking story.
Yes.
One story that was rather shocking given its source, and another story that was completely not shocking given its source.
Yeah.
Although it was kind of pathetic. Let's talk about the not shocking first. National Review.
Yeah.
And I told you last night, I discovered something about myself. I don't mind getting angry at Chuck Todd. I don't mind being disgusted with David Brooks. But it bothers me when I shrug my shoulders and give up on the humanity of someone. And I just think, oh, my God, you are just pathetic.
Yep.
But the staff of the National Review, that's how I feel about them. And I just sit there and I just think, oh, my God, you poison penned douchebags. You are just hopeless. They wrote one of them wrote an article. What kind of scandal would force Hillary to withdraw her candidacy?
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. So that then you can go on for 800 words about all of the things that maybe Hillary did do that would stop her from being president of the United States. Uh-huh. So maybe we need to look at murder, you know, like we had that death list, we could. And really, that was in the article. And we're just kidding at the end about all of the Clinton friends that have died. But, you know, no one's really looked into that. Ha ha.
Uh-huh.
That's just pathetic. I mean, they have nothing else. And they've lost all credibility because they've lied so many times.
Well, they have nothing except their subscribing readership.
Well, that's true, too, who want to hear this. This is what,
And they have nothing except occasionally their editor gets invited on Meet the Press to share his opinions with the world. So, yeah, absolutely. They are as dreadful and awful and bottom-feeding and scummy and pathetic. They have nothing else. They're just a bunch of dicks sitting around in a clubhouse talking about, wouldn't it be cool if Hillary had killed somebody? Yeah, that would be cool. Maybe she did kill somebody. Ah, maybe she did. Hey, I'll write about it. No, you write about it. Oh, that'd be awesome. And they take a shit in a bucket and lower it down to their audience who gobble it up.
Yeah.
Which would be pathetic in and of itself, except they have a national voice. And they are occasionally...
The reason they have a national voice is you got to have both sides.
Right.
You know.
And they're taken seriously. They're occasionally taken seriously.
Yep.
By people who are in the quote-unquote legit media, which is why the legit media is the problem.
Yeah.
National Review is not the problem. They are problematic. They're certainly an opportunistic virus that will infect any opening you give them. But the national media gives them that opening. That's why the problem, I really do believe that liberals should stop training their guns at Rich Lowry and people like that and swing their guns on Chuck Todd and take down a couple of big people. I mean, take down Bill Kristol. Take down David Brooks. Take down Chuck Todd. Make them sweat in public. Show up at their meetings and ask them really hard questions like John Stewart had the balls to ask Judith Miller.
And then he was just sad at the end of that interview because she is an impervious wall of lie and she won't change. We got to switch gears. I'm sorry. Do you have
He just summed it up really well. That's all.
The other surprising thing given its source was, number one, Newsmax defended Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation.
I know.
And even the mainstream media is now realizing that this Clinton cash book is just a pile of shit. But
yeah. Benghazi.
One of the reasons they are admitting that is because the Davos class on the right gives to the Clinton Foundation and supports the Clinton Foundation.
Yep.
Christopher Ruddy over at Newsmax is involved in the Clinton Foundation and helping with some of the causes that the Clinton Foundation is working for. And yes, the Clinton Foundation took money from China and spent it in Haiti.
Yep.
And if you have a problem with that, then you have a problem with that. But that did happen. But I did learn something from this article at Newsmax.com, if you can believe that.
The first and last time that will ever happen.
Well, this article is called In Defense of the Clinton Foundation. And I did not realize that the Clinton Global Initiative does not encourage donations to itself. It seeks commitments from, I'm reading this from Newsmax, if you can believe that. I mean, the Red Sea is parting here. The Clinton Foundation seeks, quote unquote, commitments from donors and other charitable organizations to improve global health and wellness, increase economic opportunities for women in less developed nations, reduce childhood obesity, and spur economic growth in countries that desperately need the help. Those are their four things right now. After those commitments are made, no money flows into the Clinton Foundation. Donors honor their pledges directly with the non-governmental organizations that are working on those problems. So this isn't Clinton cash, it's Clinton clout.
Right.
Bill Clinton or Chelsea Clinton or Hillary Clinton come in and say, look, you know, we need money for Haiti. I use that as an example because that is one place where a Clinton Foundation has really been involved to get rubble removed from the earthquake. That was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Bill Clinton walks in and says, you know, I need a commitment from United Way or what, I'm just making that up, but commitment that you will give $1 million to the Haiti organization who's going to come in and clean the rubble out from the earthquake. He's done.
Right.
You know, he's yep. done. They've made it. They make a commitment. They pay that commitment. But and it is. It's Clinton clout. No doubt about it. It's Clinton yeah. clout. And uh-huh. you can hate that, and you can say, oh, and he's going up to people that I wouldn't do business with and asking them for money.
Yep.
You know, this is the thing that I understand the purists who say, look, Rupert Murdoch raised money for Hillary Clinton when she ran for Senate.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, is if that's a bridge too far for you, that's a bridge too far for you. I get that. But money's green wherever it comes from, and yeah. if it's helping Haiti— so be it, you know, and I understand that impetus as well. So this is something I'm not used to sending our listeners to Newsmax.
It'll never happen again. Well, I swear, it'll never happen again.
But yeah. And again, as you and I talked about this, this is again, the Davos class defending each other. And there's that. And you have, again, you have to look at all of this with a shaker of salt, not a grain of salt.
Yeah. Well, and the purpose of the Clinton cash book, I really believe this, was not to was the same as the Swift boat book.
Yeah, it's a Swift boat. Absolutely.
The idea was not to actually take a serious look at anything they're doing. The idea was to create in the minds of the Republican base and the mainstream media a memory a year from now. Now, wasn't there some scandal about the Clinton cash thing? Remember that? I mean, they have no intention of actually following through with any of this. They have no intention of putting together a serious bill of indictment against the Clintons for anything.
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
whole object of the exercise is in 2015 or 2016, people vaguely remember that Clinton scandal about the cash? Remember the emails? Remember Benghazi? And, well, maybe none of these added up to much, but the weight of them,
mm-hmm.
the sheer number mm-hmm. of scandals. Remember that? This was the 90s all over again. You just pile up bullshit scandal after bullshit scandal, and then a year later—
And none of it sticks to you. It all sticks right. to her. Yeah, and her reputation. Yeah.
And you swat away each one, or you debunk each one, and you point out why this is completely trivial compared to the scandals that you were completely okay with when George Bush was in office. But the collective effect of all of these fake scandals is that a year from now, it's the scandal-plagued Clintons.
Yeah, yep.
That's the whole yep. point. That's the yep. whole point of this book. I would like to end with good news, if you don't mind.
Yeah, and I just read the good news, too. I bet you're going to talk about the same good news I did. But go ahead.
The headline of our local paper.
Oh, okay. No, I was that's good news. We'll share that. I just want you to know that Baltimore's state's attorney has made the Friday announcement they were going to make, and Freddie Gray's death has been ruled a homicide, and criminal charges will be pursued. So,
right. My good news is that our governor Hedge Fund, as you know, got into office.
He looked under his mattress this morning, didn't he?
Well, he took the oath of office. This is a little bit of history. He took the oath of office and immediately set about whacking every program for poor people and disadvantaged people, up to and including helping poor people bury their dead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He left people at the morgue.
Yeah.
And there's a program that if you have no one and no money and no one has claims your body, that the state will bury you.
Right.
He cut that.
Along with everything else he could lay his hands
on. Zero. He cut burying the dead, the dead bodies lying around in Illinois.
To zero.
To zero.
All the people, because Illinois really does have a big deficit, the idea was that next year's budget is what he would go after. So the governor's deal with the legislature was, you know, I'll go after next year's budget. I need these special powers to move money around. Mostly we're talking about the 2016 budget, next year's budget. And he got his wish and he got his special powers. He said, oh, by the way, I'm cutting all the shit this year, too. All the stuff you're actually using today, this minute, to operate your extremely efficient nonprofits and other organizations and programs to help poor people, to help children with disabilities, blah, blah, blah. All the things that you and I believe in. Boom, that's all gone, too. Ha ha, suck on that because we have a deficit. And that came as a real surprise, even to Republican legislators who said, wait a minute, that is not what we proposed. That's not what we signed up for. What the hell are you doing? And his spokesman basically said, what? What are you talking about? We were very clear. This is what we're going to do. Suck it. Well, today, the headline of the paper was the Governor Hedge Fund announces that he's putting all that money back. Because there was a sudden influx of revenue. Apparently, in the last 48 hours, they collected $26 million in taxes they weren't expecting. He went through his sofa cushions, and there was money there. Yeah. I have a suspicion, since this is coming out of the governor's office and his spokespeople are developing a really amazing reputation for just making shit up as they go along, that it wasn't so much an influx of sudden influx of money, which, by the way, I thought all that money had to go pay the deficit down. I mean, the whole point of this is we have to cut these programs because the deficit is so very bad. No. I have a feeling that there was a sudden influx of really pissed off phone calls.
From white people.
From white Republicans.
No offense, but yeah.
Whose kids and whose relatives are affected by certain programs.
Grandkids have autism.
Wanted to know why the hell he was doing this to, I voted for you, man. I voted for you. I gave you money. I contributed to your campaign, and you're cutting my grandkid out of the program that's helping him. What the hell's your problem?
Yeah.
You know, the wink and the nod, very much like in Baltimore, is that you're going to go after those people. Those people don't deserve funding, but I do.
Yeah. And we saw a letter in the paper.
We did.
Along those very lines of,
absolutely.
You know, you give money to drunks and moochers. My grandchild has autism. Yeah,
right.
And it was, and you knew, you were just waiting for that line. My grandchild has autism.
Right. And God bless him for being honest about it. But the good news is the governor touched the hot stove and he's putting the money back. And the programs that help people that we love and care about and causes that we care about deeply is at least going back for this fiscal year.
And you got to fight that battle all over again. And maybe like a cat, the governor will remember what the hot stove felt like and stay away from the stove. But you don't know that. So
speaking of Internet Kitties,
each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Rascal. And Rascal was sent in by our friend Raymond, who sends us all those great science fiction books. This is his brother's kitty. So go check out Rascal at our Facebook page and website. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com. We're running low on Internet Kitties.
Come on, people.
Where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go, Postal Unions! Letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. If you're still waiting for your tax refund in order to donate, we totally get that. Thank you for sharing a bit of that with us. We appreciate it. And you know, they just cashed our check at the IRS the 27th. So
yeah.
They're running late. I mean, and that's not surprising. We mailed our taxes in on time. We had to pay a little bit. And I was waiting. I was like, they haven't cashed our check yet. It took them a couple of weeks. Okay.
Thanks, Obama.
Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and our postal address info is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. Hey, Drift Class, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties would like to wish everyone a happy International Workers' Day. And P.S., every day, the Internet Kitties are on strike.
Let's think about living. Think about living. Let's think about loving. Think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the humping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University comes to us from Dogface Terman. This week, it's the Sex Robots episode of Science Fiction University. We are not doing fembots from the Mike Myers movies, though. There's no fembots in this Science Fiction University. And there's a new movie out about sex robots. Sexy robot, anyway. You know that one?
Ex Machina,
yeah. I haven't seen that one yet, but I'm sure
it's about someone's ex, I believe, but I'm not sure. You know, maybe I got it wrong. Maybe I didn't understand it.
I'm worried about you and your dating history, and then I realize you're married to me, so
yeah.
Don't have to worry about that no more.
I got to home base just fine. Thank you very much.
All right, so Science Fiction University and Dogface Terman says, sex robots, I'm guessing these were written by men.
Yeah, well.
All right, let's try these out and see if you can identify the sex robots or the robots having sex or whatever.
All right. Okay.
All right, number one.
You are fully functional, aren't you?
Of course, but...
How fully?
In every way, of course. I am programmed in multiple techniques. A broad variety of pleasure.
You jewel. That's exactly what I hoped.
Well, that's the Star Trek: The Next Generation. That's Data.
Yeah.
When he's getting jiggy with one of the ladies on the crew.
Who had boyfriend issues, right?
Who had boyfriend issues, as I recall, because her boyfriend was not, you know, emotionally available to commitments and stuff. So why not pick up with an appliance with a nice face? So, and then she got kind of disappointed that Data, who kept telling her, because I'm an android, it wouldn't quite sing it. She could fix him. She knew she could fix him. And it didn't work out.
That's the sequel to Earth Girls Are Easy, which is Mensa Boys Are Tough.
We don't fix. No.
You go with the flow or you don't go. That's it. Yeah. All right. Number two.
Oh, where were you going? Home?
I don't have one. We scared each other pretty good, didn't we?
We sure did.
I'm hungry, Jaya.
I got stuff inside. You want to come in?
I was hoping you'd say that.
Oh, come on now. This is Blade Runner.
Yeah.
That's Daryl Hannah playing the sexy replicant. Who I'm not sure is a robot. She's designed to look like a human being, but I think for the science fictional purposes we give her a pass on that. But yeah, she was definitely a pleasure bot, a pleasure model. And good for her.
And she was the love interest for Rutger Hauer in that. They deeply cared about each other. And it was not, even though they were criminal and violent and enraged and so forth, they showed a human side with that relationship.
They were designed to be disposable and they didn't want to be disposed of. And they took
great offense at that. Yeah.
They took matters into their own hands.
All right. Number three.
Is that your best, Slayer?
No.
Why not?
I want to hurt you, but I can't resist the sinister attraction of your cold and muscular body.
Maybe I should repay you for your gentleness. Maybe I should let you go.
No. No, Spike. Never let me go.
Oh, okay. Well, if it's Slayer, it would be, once again, a show I didn't watch very often, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which must have had a robot in this scene somehow.
It had a Buffy bot, according to Dogface Terman, there was a Spike in the Buffy bot. Okay. You'll recognize number four, I think. Here you go.
We are programmed to function as human females, Lord.
You are?
Yes, my Lord.
Harry Mudd programmed you?
Yes, my Lord.
That unprincipled, evil-minded, lecherous kulak Harry Mudd programmed you?
Yes, my Lord.
This place is even better than Leningrad.
Oh, yeah, that would be a Harcourt Fenton Mudd, of Mudd's Women.
He created some sex robots, I think.
He did.
The deal, right?
He created a bunch of sex robots, one guy, one male or a bunch of male robots, but there was only one that was unique that was in charge of the whole matter. And he kept a replica of his ex-wife just so he could shut her off. And this is another one of those episodes where I believe Jim Kirk destroys the computer villain by talking it to death.
Oh my!
So because he was good at that.
I'm gonna have to watch that one again. Yeah. That's one I do remember. That his ex-wife, he put a robot of his ex-wife in a box and she nagged at him and he just said shut up and turned her off and it made him happy. I do remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, number five.
I'm not trying to be a leader or anything, but we're not supposed to delve quite so specifically into housework.
Easy On's really that good, is it?
Isn't that good?
Well, if time is your enemy, make friends with Ezeon. That's all I can tell you. It's so good that if ever I became famous and the Ezeon people asked me, would I do a commercial? Not only would I do it, I'd do it for free. That's how good it is.
Oh, that's the Stepford Wives.
Yes, it is.
That's got to be the Stepford Wives. Yeah. That was that. Yeah, absolutely. Yes,
a horror movie. When you think about it. Yes, it was a horror movie.
Unless, you know, it's 1962 and you're Don Draper. In which case, maybe it's not a horror movie at all. Maybe it's a dream come true.
All right, number six.
Alicia's been with me now for 11 months. It's difficult to write down what has been the sum total of this very strange and bizarre relationship. Is it man and woman? Or man and machine? I don't really know myself. But there are times when I do know that Alicia is simply an extension of me. I love Alicia. Nothing else matters.
Oh, this one actually we talked about.
We did. I think so. What do you think it is?
This is an episode of The Twilight Zone. I'm not sure what the name of it is, but it's about a guy on a prison asteroid, which is not cost effective.
Which is really funny because you and I were telling me this story maybe 3 days ago.
Yeah. Well, there's a famous story called Helen O'Loy, which is a lady robot falling in love with a lady robot short story from the
50s. I know why, too. We are talking about it in the context of Ex Machina or Ex Machina.
Yeah.
The movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You said it sounds a lot like this. The plot of that movie sounds a lot like this episode of The Twilight Zone. You were telling me about Prison Planet and feeling sorry for the prisoner, leaving him a robot, and then he gets a reprieve, right, at the end?
Right. Well, it's this desolate planet. There's nothing on it except junk, and he's been condemned to exile, and it's driving him crazy. And he has an old car that he tinkers with and a bunch of other things, and it's just terrible. And the crew that brings him supplies every 6 months, that's the only human beings he ever sees. Mm-hmm. And the captain feels sorry for him. I forget who the first or second mate is. It might have been like Martin Landau or Leslie Nielsen. You know, it was Twilight Zone, so they had stars on there. But the captain felt really sorry for him and left him a female robot companion. Mm-hmm. Who he fell in love with, and he hated her at first and resented her at first, and finally came to, you know, accept her and depend on her and fell in love with her. And then, of course, because it's the Twilight Zone, he got a reprieve. And he was taken back to Earth, and he could only carry, you know, a couple of books. They had to leave right away, and he could only keep a couple of books. And he had to leave her behind.
He couldn't say goodbye, right. He couldn't say goodbye to her, yeah.
And he had to hide her from the crew. You want to do 2 minutes on Mad Men?
Sure.
Okay.
By the way, we're going to do 2 minutes on Mad Men.
It's in the notes, honey.
Mad Men wasn't quite as sad this week, except that they're losing their identity and spoiler alert, they're losing their identity as owners of their own agency. They're being absorbed by the big one.
I thought it was a wonderful episode because it was the end of everything. This guy who has marched indestructibly through the 60s. I mean, this is a guy who's gone through the entire decade of the 60s. Pretty much untouched. I mean, he has wrecked a lot of people's lives, and he's been a drunk, and he's lost a couple of marriages, but he is still Don fucking Draper, and he still romances beautiful women. He can still write $1 million check to make his problems go away. He can still sort of get away with everything.
Yep.
And he came to learn the very hard way that he actually was a renter of the American dream. He didn't own it. It was owned by someone else. Someone else was the landlord. And I, on my blog, I used the old song, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Because it's the story of a guy who loses everything, but really loses everything. Don Draper is going to be rich no matter what happens, unless he dies or unless people figure out who he really is and his identity is exposed and something tremendously bad happens. He'll be rich till the day he dies.
Yep.
And so he's not going to suffer horribly. But there's a line about building a tower to the sun. You know, the from the Depression era song, but we did great things. We did these awesome things. We built towers and we plowed the earth and we marched off to war and we built a railroad. And now I have nothing. Now I'm on a breadline begging for food. It's not quite the same. That would be the generation preceding Don's, where people actually made shit. You know, people actually built stuff. Don Draper hasn't built anything. Don Draper has found that in this post-war world that's awash in money and pent-up desire, he can make an enormously good living just being clever with words. Just putting together, tinkering together, you know, ways of selling laxatives and Porsches to people with more money than know what to do with. And that has made him an enormously rich and powerful man. And since he has built nothing, it can all be taken away from him very quickly. And so the other agency, the giant agency that has always been his competitor, and they've always been dodging out of its way, has just eaten them whole, just swallowed them whole. And for Don, that's for his little band of what I refer to as indentured millionaires. This is just awful. Oh my God, we lost the dream. The dream was to have our little agency and then we could be independent, do whatever we wanted, and they come up with a crazy scheme. I listened to the Andy Greenberg blog, which is a very good blog on Grantland, and it was a heist film. He likened it to a heist film, and it really kind of was. You know, this is Draper's 11. We're going to put the gang back together again. We're going to have this heist, and we're going to get away with it. We're going to go in, and we're going to sucker them, and we'll have the great presentation, and Don is great doing presentations, and we have laxative companies, and we have other things that we can bring to the table, and we're showing them that, look, let us be ourselves, and we'll make you money. And that's really all you care about, right? So they have this crazy scheme that they're going to go in and save the day again, and it just fails. You know, Don gets three words in edgewise, and the head of McCann just says, shut up. You know, you won. We're taking you over. You're going to be very rich. You're going to work for us. It's great. Everything's fine, you know? But no, we're not going to let you have your little tinker toy agency. This has been decided years ago. We decided this long ago. This is part of our plan. And for them, it's the end of everything. Oh, crap, we lost the agency. We'll go down swinging. We'll do great. And they go out to tell the troops, don't worry, we'll figure something out. And the troops all head off with their resumes looking for other jobs.
You know, this isn't
their cause. They can look out their window and see what a real cause looks like. You know, a real cause looks like civil rights or the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
A real cause looks like gay rights and women's rights. This is just a job to them.
Work is not going to be life for anyone below Don Draper.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is not their identity. This is just a place where they draw a paycheck.
Yeah.
And they might love it or they might hate it or they might resent going to work for another agency or they might not. But this isn't who they are. This is just what they do. Don has always gotten off the sofa, sobered up, and leaped into action to rally the troops. And this time the troops aren't interested in being rallied. I did a little research, very little research, mind you. I don't work that hard at doing this. But when they saved the agency the first time, it was 1963.
Mm.
And according to my copy of Spider Robinson's short story, The Time Traveler, which is a wonderful little short story, which is not science fiction much at all, it was about a guy who was taken prisoner in South America in 1963 and is released in the 70s and wants to commit suicide because he can't cope with all the changes. And all the people at the bar where he's telling the story can't figure out what he's talking about. He said, well, because you've lived through the changes. He said, when I went to prison in 1963, there were 33 people dead who'd been killed total in this little place called Vietnam.
When I
went to prison in 63, Dick Nixon was a washed-up hack who was never going to be heard from again. I come back to the United States, and I'm given the great honor of meeting the President of the United States. And who is it? It's Dick Nixon. I can't cope with it. I mean, I can't cope with the amount of change that has been gone through. And that's the arc of this story. It's from the days when setting up an agency was actually a big cause. It was a thing that you could throw yourself into. To the time when it's just another job. And Don made it all the way through the 60s, brushing off problems. You know, just this is someone else's issue and the virtue of reinventing and rebuilding yourself. And he's run out of the ability to do that anymore, and he can't rally his troops anymore. So this is really the end of his story. I thought it was an elegant, well-told story. And the guy who played Lane Price, the gentleman who is the account manager.
Yeah, who wound up committing suicide in the office. Yeah.
Who's also Moriarty.
Yes, in the Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr. Yeah.
His name's Jared Harris, and he directed this episode.
Oh, okay.
And all so right. he let Pete have a punch. I thought it was a lovely piece of composition art, and the reason it worked is because as an episode itself, it worked great. But everything that went on, every gesture, every time Pete and Peggy shared a sofa, when Peggy gives this wonderful speech about feminism, and she doesn't call it feminism, but she calls it how you have to, what the price you pay for being a woman in a man's world.
Yep.
And the kids she had to give up.
Mm-hmm.
All of this enormous history these people have together is what bears on every new thing they do. And that's what gives it this tremendous amount of weight and depth to it that other shows just don't have.
Joan has a real sense of feminism too.
She does.
She understands that McCann has no accounts for her. Nobody even mentioned that she would have an account. She has no illusions about how she's going to be treated in the big among the big boys.
She and Peggy had that meeting.
Yes.
And boys.
They were just
treated
awful.
Her like shit. I mean, they treated her like,
a whore.
The sex bot. Sex bot. And she knows absolutely certainly that's exactly how she's going to be treated. And everything she's built up, all the reputation, all the friendships, all the relationships, all the equity is gone. Yeah. That's just been taken away from her by somebody else. She had this big speech with Don. Two seasons ago about it, how nice for you that you have choices and we all just sitting around waiting for you to decide what we should do with our lives. And this is one more case of, you know what, you're a woman. Doesn't really matter how accomplished you are, how rich you are, how talented you are. Some other guy in some other building in some other part of town has just decided what your life is going to be. And now he comes to your office and pats you on the head and said, you should be happy about it because we're going to give you a lot of money. So, I thought it was really well done. Way to go, Jared Harris, and that's my add-on.
A couple more episodes left.
Yep.
And then that's it.
And then that's over. And then they go on and make movies every 5 years.
you think?
I think they're going to do that.
On the Enterprise?
No. They're going to do that 7-Up, 14-Up, 21-Up. Every 7 years, they're going to get them back together again to make another movie about what's happening now? What's going on now? Oh my God, Pete's gay? Really? Yeah, he came out in his piece. Yeah. Anyway,
thank you very much, everybody, and
my
we'll
pleasure.
See you next week.
See ya. Love you too, beautiful. Bye.